All right, let's get started. Thank you guys for being here today. And thank you folks for, who are calling in and on the phone. Let's start with roll call.
Chris Beck.
Here.
Faye Gallant. Greg Frick. Sherry Rolfe. Leslie Walls.
Here.
Jamie Warwick.
Here.
Jessica DeRochers. Debbie Coxon. Jesse Atencio. Lawrence Murakami.
Hello.
Janine Smith.
Here.
Jan Christensen.
Here.
Jane Grossclose.
Here.
Kim Eames.
Here.
Juan Gula. Jeff Baxter.
Here.
Trish Winters.
Here.
Jessica McCallum.
Here.
Susan Sanborn.
Here.
Jeanette Altman. Nate Bauer.
Here.
Richard Machida.
Here.
I've got Earl Voorhees for Yorko.
Here.
Evelyn Pinsgaard. Selena Brown. Tom Langdon. Tony Abbey. Anybody whose name I did not call. Did any staff council representatives just join?
Somebody just joined on the phone? Yeah. Okay.
Quorum is met.
Thank you.
Chris, we're having a really hard time hearing anybody in the room.
Okay.
We can hear you, but anybody else is very, very faint.
All right. We'll make sure that people use their microphones today. Let's move on to item C, approval of the agenda. So here, a motion for approval? Okay.
Second.
All right. Anybody wants to add or change anything? Hearing none. All in favor of approving the agenda for today?
Aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Item D, approval of minutes. Council meeting 254 and 245 are part of your packet.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Thank you. Moving on to status of pending actions. The leaf share resolution is still with UAA. They had some questions and they had some things they wanted to talk with HR about at UAA. At Staff Alliance, we kind of said, hey, it's been 4 months since we proposed this. We did a lot of the work. I mean, if you look at the whole documentation along with it, we asked those questions. They're answered there. Can you just...
It sounded like
And it sounded like a lot of their questions that they had were about leave share in general and not about our proposed changes to leave share. So we made our... I wouldn't say impatience. We made it known that our patience had been stretched severely, and I think we'll be voting at the next Staff Alliance meeting, regardless of whether UAA has gotten on board or not. So, and since Statewide and Southeast have passed resolutions in support, it should move. So.
Yeah. So I suspect that will move forward. next month to the statewide governance offices and onto the president. Hopefully, he will look favorably upon that and implement that. Implement a policy for leaf share. Any questions on that? Cool. Thank you. Bullying awareness training resolution. We got our memo back. Approved. The dates reflect that. Initially we had dates in there that said by the end of this year, which is, you know, we're a little more than a month left. So that's been moved to June 2015, so June next year. But other than that, the memo is pretty much the same. We've got a resolution that was signed there by Brad initially, and then by the chancellor as well. So that's been approved with some revisions there. I don't remember where the...
I think the revisions were basically really the timeline.
Yeah, the dates have been changed.
The timelines was their revisions, yeah.
Anything else, everything else pretty well stayed the same. So as far as I know, that's finished. So.
What were the revisions to the timeline?
For supervisors, it would be required starting January 1st. So moving into the new semester, it would be a requirement for supervisors. They didn't want to roll it out in the middle.
Sure.
And then it's available for employees. So it was just moving that required date for supervisors from, I think we had originally had July 1st or something.
July 1st.
So.
It now says, and this is at the bottom of the memo, June 30th, 2015. So it really just updates it with the current timeline. Other questions? Okay. And item C, emergency leave policy. In talking with Chancellor's office yesterday, that's still... pending a bit. However, the way it looks like right now is that for this year, there will be the emergency leave policy is kind of what they've been talking about, which is adding 2 sick leave days that can be used for emergency weather leave. For the year after that, there will be something in the trend of a personal safety days. So there will be another category of leave that can then be used for weather emergency. So for this year, it looks like it's going to be 2 days out of the sick leave that can be used for emergency leave. For the following years, it'll be its own category with its own personal, it sounds like personal safety leave or something in that trend.
And just to clarify on that too, it will be if the chancellor or like a campus director declares weather emergency, so not if localized at your house you have a personal weather emergency where, you know, a tree comes down but everything else is perfectly fine. That would be you would use your normal leave. But if there's a weather event, then the campus can be the chancellor or campus director.
The chancellor will declare emergency weather day that you can use that leave for now. Any questions on that?
When will that go into effect?
We should be seeing a message within like the next 2 weeks, I think Kari said to us, but we can ask the chancellor when he calls in for us today to check on his timeline.
Yeah. And for next year, I assume that that's going to be July 1st. How soon details about that are published, I'm not sure. But good question. Others? On the phone, maybe? Okay, moving on to public comment. I know David's here. He asked to speak. Anybody else here for public comment? On the phone? Anybody on the phone for public comment? Okay, David?
Okay, thank you, Chris. I'm Dave Witoff. I am actually adjunct faculty this right now, but I used to be staff. And I wanted to offer an update regarding my thoughts on university policy on term-funded staff. I've done a fair bit of research on the legal and personnel issues and remain interested in participating in the conversations to address the situation without getting into a lot of details. As I understand it, right now, everyone in this room, and this is especially true of term staff, is subject to termination without cause at any time, and you don't even get to file a grievance, which is out there in the ragged edges of being legal under constitutional due process protections, and perhaps more importantly, I don't think it's good personnel policy. So I think there's a win-win solution to this problem if we just sit down and have a conversation with all of the stakeholders, but right now the conversation seems to be stalled. The only communication I've had has been with university lawyers, which, as you might expect, is a rather skewed conversation. And I don't think that Superior Court is the right place to be resolving the issue anyway, and I'd rather not. I don't think anybody wants to go that route, so I just wanted to take this brief opportunity to express my continued interest in inspiring a more, somehow unstalling the conversation and inspiring a process that could maybe result in some improvement. Thank you.
Thank you, David. We've got a committee that is looking at that. I know it's been little low activity there, but we'll talk more about that during the rest of the meeting and see if we can resurrect a little activity in there. Based on Brad Loblin's comments last meeting, I would love that. Love it if that committee looked at the two things he seemed to be interested in at least discussing and maybe improving upon, which was notification period for people that are term funded and non-renewed. There is currently no a set period of days or time in where term funded employees are supposed to be notified. Technically speaking, that could be less than 24 hours. He recognizes that that isn't a very good thing. In practice, his office has been doing 30 days. However, there doesn't appear to be any type of notification period set in policy or regulation. And so I would love for that committee to look at that, maybe propose that. The other thing is a grievance process, kind of what David touched on earlier. Again, based on his comments last meeting, it sounds like he's open to discussing that and improving upon that as well. In his words, he is looking to make sure that that process is open and transparent. He and his office would like to work on improving that, and so I think that's an opportunity for us to do so. So thank you. Thank you for your comment. Appreciate that. Anyone else here for public comment? Okay. On the phone? Okay. Moving on to governance reports then. Matthew, are you on the phone? Nope, not here, Matthew. I saw Dabu walking in. Dabu, little. Sure. Dabu Misra from Faculty Senate.
Thank you. So thank you very much for this opportunity time. I just have not much to report, but one thing that is now. We all know we are in a tight budget situation, and I'm hearing that from many faculty, staff. Morale is a little bit low at this point. Everything is being evaluated. So nothing has happened so far, which is the good news. But things will happen, you know, and that's going. So that's where I think governance is very critical. We should all work together to see how to move the university forward. That's the The other thing that I have is during this period of time, I'm seeing that more and more training is being imposed on everybody. And one that came to my particular attention and I'm is the something about the minors in higher education. And I don't know if we all require that. And sometimes this is coming to us as a mandatory training when initially it was decided that it was not mandatory for everybody. The problem I see with this is that we are losing staff hours, faculty hours, by doing that, which we may not use, maybe probably once in a lifetime, and those kind of things needs to be evaluated, and we need to provide a feedback on what kind of trainings are important for who. I mean, slip, trip, and fall, I can understand. Yes, each one of us need to be aware of that situation, okay? Or Title IX is okay, is a good thing because we want to keep the campus safe. We don't have minors that are walking around the campus, and bringing those type of training and losing hours on that is something that bothers me completely. It's not gone through the governance process, and it's something being imposed. I just wanted to thought that I will bring it up for a discussion, if at all. The only other thing that I can think of at this point is we are, the Faculty Alliance has decided that now we should what is called the general education requirement alignment across the three campuses and calendar alignment. So both of those are going on. I know it doesn't affect the staff to a great extent, except it will start affecting once we know more about it. I mean, there will be some changes that will occur due to that in staff that are working, for example, in registrar's office, or I don't know where things are. I mean, it's still very unknown at this point. The other concern that I have is this: with all these budgetary constraints and programs being earmarked for review, I'm not using the word deletion yet, for special review. What will be the impact of calendar alignment and general education requirements is another question that is still we have to all struggle with. So with that, I'll stop today, and thank you all for the opportunity, and I'll take questions if any.
Yes. So, the general education alignment, what is kind of your understanding of how long that timeline could take? Is that like a project that you're going to be working on for the next couple of years?
Yes. So this is currently a resolution by the Board of Regents. They have resolved that we need to align, so they want to see a plan of alignment by January 2016. So that's our deadline to provide a plan. And I think we can come up with a plan. Next thing will be the implementation of that plan. Now that's going to be, I'm hoping not in my presidency, because that's going to be a mess after that point, okay? At this point, what has happened is math has pretty much, math and English were the first two that were required, to align things. Math has come up with some alignment strategy, so they are doing okay. English is another big animal that's going into some discussions and other stuff. They have a first meeting, and I'm anticipating a whole lot of issues coming up from just the English alignment. Now we are moving into the next domain, which is aligning social sciences, natural sciences, and art, and other stuff. And that one is going to be the biggest hurdle, because I'll tell you something else that has happened. So the statewide wants to lower the, well, not lower, come up with a minimum baccalaureate standards for admission of students, which sounds very reasonable, except the three universities have no way of agreeing on what was proposed. So that, you know, this is a simple, small thing. And we have been debating and fighting about it, and I have, like, at least 100 email exchanges on that, you know, that issue alone. So that tells me where we are heading forward. But what I'm more concerned about is the loss of time. You know, when staff has a very important role, in my opinion, okay, they support the faculty because then the faculty can have time to teach properly. I mean, what is their job? Do the research and service. Okay, so those are the three things. What is happening slowly, I see, and this has come up very frequently right now, is that more and more of the administrative work is being pushed on the faculty. This guy, you know, I'm not necessarily saying the alignment of calendars or whatever. You know, that's one. Okay. Should we do that? Yes, we should. Okay, but there has to be some reasonability on that is my big problem. Okay, I mean, if I spend out of 8 hours, 4 hours at least for the calendar alignment, then that's a misuse of the time, as opposed to if I spend probably 4 hours in a week, then that's probably okay. But what I'm seeing is more and more of those things are coming up, and that's distracting faculty hours. That's distracting staff hours. I'm not saying that staff are being released of those times. So basically, there is a situation that is occurring, probably due to the budget constraint. I don't know if that's what it is, but we need to keep an eye out and see how we can best achieve. Moving forward, you know, that's my goal.
Thank you. Anybody on the phone?
Well, Brad has a question.
Yeah. Go ahead, Brad. Sorry.
So Debbie, I heard you say that that we don't have programs, we don't have minors on campus, and I don't know numbers, but I can confirm we do have programs that bring minors on campus, and we also have minors who are just coming onto campus. You know, crossing from West Valley over the bridge, but there are definitely minors on campus.
No, I understand that. Okay. Okay. So the protection of minors, or whatever the second one is, I'm okay with the first one. There are two aspects of the thing. Okay. The first one is how to handle minors, and that's okay. You know, we have all taken that. There is still a December 31 deadline, and I agree with that one. Okay. That we should all have a knowledge of how to handle minors on campus. The other one is more specific. Like, you know, let us say there is a museum visit, and I'm not there. You know, I don't have any job there. But those who are really handling minors, they should know the protection of the minors. That's what my concern is. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I did not clarify that.
No,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Debu.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here.
Matthew? I'll be sitting here.
Yeah, please. Matthew, I saw you come in. Thanks for being here. Matthew Carrick is president of ASUS.
Thank you very much. So I want to talk about three things today. One, the reaction in student government to the proposed tobacco-free policy was not super great. There's a resolution being circulated right now, and it's going to be voted on probably on Sunday. So that, just letting you guys know, that's something that we're going to be issuing an official statement on sometime soon. Secondly, we're going to be having our elections. They're going to be happening next week on Monday the 24th and Tuesday the 25th. So if you interact with student government, there might be some turnover there. How this affects you really is if you're affiliated with a student club or you're a staff advisor to a student club, then I would encourage you to tell your students that they should sign up to be poll workers there because they can fundraise for a club. They can make $10 an hour minimum there, and it's a pretty easy, no-stress way to fundraise. And third, we have finalized the selection for our team for the Juneau Legislative Advocacy Trip, which is a spring event that's coordinated on a statewide level by the Coalition of Student Leaders and sends students from every campus wishing to participate to Juneau to advocate on behalf of the university for funding from state legislators. What we've mostly received in terms of information on what we should advocate for is operating costs in general and for capital projects, the engineering building, and updating the fire station building. So if staff council has any recommendations on what they would like us to advocate for, if you have any ideas, please let us know. You can email me after a meeting or during the meeting. My email is mtcarrick@alaska.edu, and I put it on the sign-in sheet over there.
Cool. Right. Thanks, Matthew. Would you be so kind that your resolution, once it's if it passes, I have a feeling that it might. would you forward that to us? That'd be great.
Absolutely. I can send you the draft now, but it doesn't represent an official opinion.
Yeah. That'd be great. And then with elections, are you running for president again, or are you electing officers or representatives of this?
We're electing senators or representatives. My term doesn't come up for re-election until the spring.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Does anyone have any questions for me?
Did I hear you call it a smoke-free resolution, a campus resolution, or
tobacco? The tobacco.
Free? Tobacco. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we know that the student regent is going, her term is going to be over by May.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ASUF coming up with anybody's name or anything for the next regent?
So we do have that question on the ballot. We only accept like official candidates. There's no write-in. So we know who all the candidates are right now. We only have one. His name is Brandon Richter. He's an RA right now. And then there will be more candidates from other campuses as well.
So this might be a silly question. I'm wondering if student governance has taken a position on tuition increases. Given the budget situation and the threats to programs with the funding cuts and with tuition holding stable?
No, we haven't taken an official stance on it. I can tell you as students, we were usually, the reaction was pretty positive to hearing that there wouldn't be a tuition increase.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very good question. That's something I'll bring up at our meeting.
Yeah, I would say just noting that with basic inflation, the cost will go up no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when tuition doesn't go up, we end up looking at programs and services to cut. So it would be interesting if students governance took it up. I understand, obviously, that the natural position is no increases, but when it means that what we offer as a university decreases or gets worse, then students also might have an interest in small increases. It would be something to consider. And certainly, I think if students advocated for small increases, the regents would have a hard time opposing. So, thanks.
Hello. Hey, this is Kim, and I wonder, from what I understand, the Technology Advisory Board, that was put in place that the students voted to have the technology fee taken out of, you know, out of what they pay. And it was put together to be administered by this board, and it could be part, you know, could be applied for like a grant, and it was for, you know, technology in classrooms, upgraded equipment for various programs, and that program was completely cut this summer. The money is still being taken, but now it's being distributed to OIT, the library, and IRSA, and students no longer have a say in it. Has that been addressed by anybody?
No. Are you asking about the possibility of putting it back into the ASOAF budget?
No. Just that money was voted in by students, and students were allowed to apply for use for that, and it's now been taken away. It's completely administrative now.
There has been some investigation by the Sun Star, the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Student government as such hasn't really done anything about it now.
Okay.
Other questions for Matthew? All right, Matthew, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Moving on to staff achievements and highlights. Anybody have staff highlight? Okay. Anyone on the phone?
I don't have one, but I feel like I should speak to this because I was at the Staff Alliance meeting earlier. Was it the retreat when we talked about this that I attended for Chris? And the idea was that we wanted to, you know, at each campus solicit some just quick stories that we could share back up to Alliance that, you know, could potentially be part of the Staff Alliance Chair's report to the Regents, so that, you know, the staff report to the Regents would not be all doom and gloom all the time, which is often what it is, you know, that we could be like students and faculty and be able to say, here's some cool things that we've done. So I just feel like, since, you know, I think we haven't had too much come forward from us, I wanted to say that's what it was about. And so it's not, I know it might seem cheesy, but it's meant with good intentions. So if you do come across something, and it doesn't have to be big, it would be nice to be shared. Or if not shared, you know, in person here at the meeting, you could share it with Faye and Chris. I imagine they'd accept it over email, and they can bring it forward that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually did have two last month, so.
And on that note, I think, you know, the ones we had last month were both really good examples, one where it was part of the person's job where they were selected and traveled to this conference and reported, and the other was our chief getting selected for Rotarian of the Year Award, which was just a great personal achievement that shows our value in the community. So, you know, any of these kind of achievements, whether it's community-based or university-based, would be great to hear about and share forward.
Yeah, I had one to put a feather in our own cap, but the Geophysical Institute. Has anybody been up to the West Ridge and seen our new rocket out in front of the building? That rocket that's sitting out in front was built by staff from parts and pieces of crashed rockets, and the people at Poker Flat were amazed that it looks like it could actually fly. And if you'd seen the parts and pieces we started with, you wouldn't think it was possible. But, I mean, the thing looks great, and it was done by staff. Of course, putting it up was done with a contractor, but actually building the rocket was done by staff. And it's pretty impressive. So.
Yeah, awesome.
If you haven't been up there yet, you should take a bus ride and drive by and take a look.
So. I usually
I had no
go,
idea.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a model that we bought or something.
Oh, no,
but
we
yeah,
had to build
really
that
cool.
With, you know, we had no budget for it, so they, you know, they said, here's some parts and you can make a rocket, you know, out of this stuff, and there you go. So.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah.
No, that's a great
staff
highlight.
I thought it was
New
Year's celebration.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing, Jeff.
Of course, the only thing I'm worried about is I think maybe the Russian satellites have spotted that now. And we probably got a target on us now. But
yeah.
Well, Jesse, thanks for sharing. Appreciate that. Awesome highlight. Chester Rogers, are you on the phone online?
I am.
All right. You have the floor. Thank you.
Well, thanks. I'm sitting in Anchorage today. Sorry I can't be there in person. Probably the biggest issues I want to review are the transition, the governor's transition, and budget issues. Got a couple of other things to cover. First, on transition, we have a new governor coming in 2 weeks, and they're starting the transition process, which is both looking at the primary issues and then looking at who they want for leadership within the new administration. I know on the former, they're looking to the university, and there are some people who've been asked to serve in various roles on the governor's transition team. I'll be moderating a panel on Friday and participating in the transition team on the fiscal issues facing the state, which, as the price of oil continues to fall, are really becoming pretty dire. The state entered this fiscal year thinking they had a budget deficit in the $1 to $1.2 billion level. It's now looking like it's more in the $2.9 to $3 billion level. And at that rate, we have just 2 or 3 years' worth of reserves left, and so a very significant challenge in both operating and capital budgets likely ahead. And I would expect us to see some challenges, not just at the university, but in every aspect of state government, local government, school districts, as a result of the change in the price of oil. So it turns out the work we've been doing, based on the Planning and Budget Committee recommendations last spring, with special program reviews kicking off in a series of support function areas, and then the grouping for the academic program reviews, really timely. We look with a flat budget coming from the state, we would need about $14 million in reductions. If we get cut, that would be on top of that. And so it's going to be a challenge, and we really need everyone engaged in figuring out where are the best opportunities to save costs while minimizing impacts to missions. So I'll be discussing those further. I've got a town hall, Chancellor's Forum scheduled for next week. Publicity should be going out on that already. It's the 25th, where, as has been the case in the past, I'll open with some comments and then take questions. We have been soliciting through the Cornerstone questions online in advance, and we'll handle as many as possible. Looking forward to the spring semester. Couple of things. I know people have felt like they're inundated with requests for training, whether it's safety training or Title IX training or protection of minors training. The bullying awareness training will roll out next, and we'll be pushing as hard as we have on the others toward completion. We're doing pretty well on the safety training. We're at about 86% of employees have completed all their safety training, about 95% on the Title IX of full-time employees, so doing really well there. The protection of minors, we're asking people to complete by December 31st, so there's still work to go there. We're in the 25% of full-time employees at this point, and we'll be pushing on that. I really appreciate the staff council's pushing that one forward. And I think in a time of budget challenges when there's higher stress everywhere, an extra emphasis on the awareness is a positive. I've talked to you before about how we want to address issues of any emergency closures. The direction is different from what I had indicated earlier. Earlier we had talked about a policy that would add sick leave days and go to sick leave for emergency leave. That's not going to be the process for future years, but for this year only, if there are any emergency days, the president will authorize use of two sick leave days for emergency leave this year. But with a change of federal rules, we can allocate administrative leave costs of an emergency leave to federal grants and contracts, which has been our primary barrier. So that will be the plan beginning in FY16 and thereafter when a chancellor declares an emergency day. And so that emergency leave, I thought it was going to go out already. I'm not sure what the hang-up is, but that will go forward. It's come out of the summit team. A couple of other date things. Staff Appreciation Day, I'd like to get the date firmed up. The Wednesday after commencement has worked well in the past, and unless there are objections from the staff council, I'd like to keep to that day in the future. We could go a day or two later, but I really think that week is the best time before we lose some staff who go on summer. And I know there have been some questions about soft closure this year. We have no official soft closure because we have the grading period goes up to the 24th of December. Some people are required for that. And winter semester starts up right after. But as is always the case, supervisors and employees can work out appropriate annual leave time. So there's no announced, but frankly, some offices may be closed if the functions of that office allow. So it's just the same 3 days of hard closure between the two holidays. There's been some suggestion that we extend that with additional mandatory leave days, and I've resisted that because of the need for both grading and winter semester. And you know, I think if we wanted to make a decision for more mandatory leave days, that needs to be done well in advance of, you know, ideally at the beginning of a fiscal year. It's possible we would consider something like that in a 4th of July week at some point in the future, but no plans for that as of now. With that, let me stop, and I'm sure there are questions about transition and budget. I'd be glad to answer any that the members of staff council might have.
Thank you, Chancellor Rogers. Is there? Yep, I'll have to pay talk.
So I have a question on the emergency closures. Would the ability to declare an emergency closure day or emergency weather day also be delegated to campus directors? So if there's a weather emergency in a rural site, they can respond quickly?
I'm actually not sure what the president's final decision on that is, but I can tell you if it is not delegable by the chancellor, if a director calls me and says she or he needs to close, we're going to close.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions for the chancellor, either in the room? Seeing none, any on the phone?
Chancellor Rogers, at your town hall, where there'll be more discussion regarding the memo that you just recently sent out regarding the review of programs and the effects of maybe what it will do for staff in regards to, you know, the fact they're already on the 45-day hold or cutbacks or any of those worrisome topics?
We'll discuss any issue that people want to raise. I will go a little bit further into the program review process. The memo lays out where those areas are, and as always, we we solicit from anyone ideas for saving money or generating new revenue for the university.
Oh, this is Faye again. I'll just chime in on that. If you have ideas for cost savings or revenue generation, if you go to uaf.edu/omb, the Office of Management and Budget is collecting all of those ideas and sharing them through the Planning and Budget Committee and the Revenue Generating Committee for deeper evaluation. So that's where you can go ahead and submit any ideas, and definitely encourage everyone to submit any idea they have on that.
Other questions on the phone for Chancellor Rogers? Okay, thank you, Chancellor Rogers, for taking the time to answer our questions and to report here.
Happy to do so, and I really appreciate the staff council, and I think the level of work we're going to have in the coming year, given the tight budget, it's going to be challenging, but we will make it through these times, if we work together. I see positive outcome in the long run, even though the short run's a little scary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to our guest speaker, May Marsh. Thank you for being here, May.
Thanks for having me. And thank you for the opportunity to update you on where we are with Title IX and to talk about. We're getting a lot of buzz on a thing that's been inappropriately or misnomered as mandatory reporting, so I'm going to include a little information on that. Last January, I went to training, and when I came back, this is the slide that I used to brief the chancellor, because this is where I saw that we had gaps in our Title IX program. So I'm going to address each one of these areas so that you'll know the progress that we've made in getting in compliance with the OCR guidance. So in addition to the change that I could see that we needed to make, so in March we stood up a task force to take a look at that, to decide how can we get into compliance. Then in April we got guidance that came out from the White House, and that was the OCR's questions and answers. Plus there was a lot of guidance that came out called Not Alone from the White House. So sexual assault, which is tied to Title IX, is getting attention from the very top, and so there are a lot of changes that are occurring because it is getting so much focus. I mean, basically, there's no politician that's not on board with this, so it's moving pretty fast. Then in April, we got the notice from OCR, in May we got the notice from the OCR that they were going to come to audit the UA programs. So, not only do we know that we have gaps, but now we have an urgency to ensure that we're in compliance, because we don't want to lose our federal funding. 26% of our funding comes from the federal government, and that's the overall threat, that if we're not in compliance with this law, that they could remove our federal funding, including student aid. So, it became very urgent then. In June, we did a huge submission of documents to OCR. It was over 6,000 pages, the documents that we sent. They were from UAA, UAF, and UAS, so it was all together because it was a system review. Then in July, we did our second submission. And so, this was a lot of work in redacting cases to make sure that we didn't reveal identities, to make sure that we were in compliance with the Alaska state laws. Then also in July, August, and September, we really zoomed up training, because that's one of the requirements in the OCR guidance. So we offered the Title IX class through Skillsoft that was set up by UA Systems. We offered it in person, and then we also had our slides out on, and that's what the Chancellor was talking about. We're at a 95% completion rate, which is really good. Then in October, we had the actual OCR visit. We won't really get anything back from them for quite a while. Hawaii actually went before us, and this was like, I think, 2 years ago, and they still don't have everything resolved. So this is the only in-writing guidance or in-writing that we've gotten from OCR since. And it said, just to pass along the thanks, they were particularly impressed with the level of participation we had in our focus groups that they held with the students. They said that this was the first system of audit that they had done out of the Seattle office, that the group turnout was the best that they had ever experienced, and they thought Bethel was an amazing experience, which I'm really glad they went to Bethel because, you know, you don't get that anyplace in the lower 48. And then he also said that the tenor at UAF was different with lots of discussion about mandatory reporting. So here are the things that I identified as our gaps, and here's the progress that we've made. They say that we must have unified procedures. One of the things that the OCR team said to Mike O'Brien is your policies are not harmonized across the campuses. So, you know, what we've done is we've individually rolled this out at the different campuses. And so for UAF, the task force developed an interim procedure on how do we have a unified response. Because prior to that, Don Foley's office was responding, Res Life was responding, we were responding, but we didn't have a system. We didn't have a unified approach. So we developed a procedure. We developed templates to make sure that both the victim and the accused knew what their rights are and to gather all the information that we would need. And so this has been a collaboration through UA systems as well. So what's pending is an update to the Board of Regents policy. Mike O'Brien is looking at that, and he probably will be heading that up because it will be from all campuses as we look at how do we get our policies in compliance. And I have up here a list of things that I've identified that I'm not seeing in our policy right now. In addition to that, I really believe that we need a designated attorney. We don't have to have the complaints done in 60 days, but that's the recommended time frame. And if they set for review or if they set for signature, then that really cuts down on the time frame to do the actual investigation. The next thing is appointment of Title IX coordinators, deputy coordinators, contacts. And so these are the appointments that we've made. So no matter what campus you're on, you have someone to go to if you need information regarding Title IX or if you'd like to make a disclosure to Title IX. The tracking system, the OCR guidance says we have to have a unified tracking system because people that are perpetrators of sexual assault have patterns in their behavior. And if you can identify the pattern, then there's an opportunity to stop sexual assault before it happens. And so that's what we're looking at. Right now, what we're doing if when we get a case in, we're calling folks to see, you know, the police, do you have anything? We're calling Res Life, do you have anything? So it's a real cumbersome manual way to do this. This is something else that UA Systems is researching on how do we have a system because we have a lot of our students, I think it's like 24% of our students, cross UAA, UAF, UAS lines. So, and again, we have to have a unified tracking system for all of that. Awareness, I know you saw a lot over this past summer, and as we approach the students returning, marketing did a fabulous job. They've done brochures, they've done posters, you see it on the back of the buses. We've done interviews with the student radio system, we've had articles in the paper, safety fair, storage and gulch. We've had just a lot of things going on, but I don't think we've done enough because still folks are asking questions and don't know. I mean, I did hear one good thing. One guy told me that he came on campus and he had only been here a couple hours, and three people had talked to him about Title IX. So I was like, okay, we're making some progress. Training, there's training for the appointees. There's training for staff and faculty. There's training for student. And then we're also doing outreach to our community. Student training, I really think we have a lot more to do with that. We do have a separate task force looking at, you know, how do we ensure that our students know what their rights are, where to go if they need assistance. In addition to that, we have a separate task force that's looking at Green Dot, and that's the bystander training. So, you know, how do we stand for and with one another in stopping sexual assault? How we do we do an intervention before it ever occurs? So the example you probably saw in our training was that if I'm at a bar and I see someone drop a drug in someone's drink, you know, I may not be the type of person that would go up and do a confrontation with that individual, but I could tell a bartender, I could pretend I'm drunk and knock it over. It has the same impact. You still have to help someone that was a potential victim of sexual assault. So we're looking at, you know, how do we build that repertoire of here's what I'll do if I see something and do interventions in a non-confrontational way. And so Keith Mallard's heading that up. We're looking at how can we collaborate with the school districts, especially out in Western Alaska, because it's very expensive to go there. And so we're, you know, can we share, can we do training for you and you share with our expenses? So we're looking at that. And we're also looking at how do we reach our distance ed students, because that's another thing that Alaska has that a lot of, that, you know, with that not, well, they do have it in a lower 48, but we do have a lot of it. The climate survey, we were looking at rolling out the climate survey before OCR got here. But with the reviews and the approvals, it got it didn't get out as soon as we'd hoped. Then we were looking at getting out the 1st of November. That didn't happen. So now we're like, wait till after the holidays, because this is really sensitive stuff, and we don't want to re-stimulate anyone and put them in a crisis over the holidays. So this will be coming out sometime next year. It also gives us a chance to look at it, because not all of the instruments that are out there have been tested. And so we're, you know, looking at, you know, what other universities have used these instruments. Are they effective? We were looking mainly at the White House instrument that came out. Then, of course, you know, after we get the information, we have to do analysis of that, and we have to make an action plan. So, for instance, if it indicates that there's something going on around a particular dorm, or you know, if there's some risk, then we have to have an action plan on how are we going to correct that. They want us to have memorandums of understanding with local police, and so we are working towards that. We did sign a statewide memorandum of understanding with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and so that allows us to share materials, share grants, share services. And I'm working very closely with the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, trying to get a victim advocate. Right now, they can support us from their facility. So we have gotten approval to provide transportation. So if someone needs transportation from campus to their facility and back, we can do that for them. Hopefully, in the future, we'll be able to maybe write a grant, get some money, so that we can have an additional advocate on campus. That is such a critical element, because when someone's traumatized, they're not, you know, they really need someone to take their hand, explain to them, here's the legal process, here's what's going to typically what will happen with you. I mean, it's not unusual for people to wait 3 to 6 months before they report anything because of the trauma. And I just think that is such an essential piece that I would like to ensure that we have on campus. We have lots of resources off campus. We have a whole list of off campus, but it'd be nice to have someone here. And then the police, we've started meetings with the police. That's still, we've still got a lot of work to do in that area. Okay, here we go to mandatory reporting. And so what I'm trying to do is explain that there is a difference between disclosure and reporting. And disclosure is if you are a victim. You know, what are your choices? Where can you go? What can you do? And so if you're a victim of sexual assault, you are in control. And so you can tell no one, and that's pretty typical that you tell no one. And then when you get to the point where you want to tell someone, you can go to UAF Health and Counseling if you want to report or to disclose this in a confidential manner. You can go to the any of the agencies with the network. And you can also go to the Alaska Interior Center for Nonviolent Living. If you come to Title IX, even after it's been reported to us, that individual can request confidentiality. And we honor that. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then the third option that you have is law enforcement. We've always had the health and counseling. We've always had law enforcement. Title IX is the new piece, and it's an administrative process where we can take action if we have someone violating our policies. Now, reporting is what is expected of staff, faculty, you know, the members of our community. Mandatory reporting has to do with Alaska state law, and it has to do with the position you hold. And, you know, like, for instance, if you're a teacher in the school district, you are a mandatory reporter, because if you learn about sexual assault, if it involves a minor, if that individual is at risk of harming themselves or someone else, or if they're a vulnerable adult, like my mother who has Alzheimer's, she would be considered a vulnerable adult because she cannot make reasonable, rational decisions on her own. So, you know, if someone was taking advantage of a vulnerable adult. I don't know who the mandatory reporters are here on campus. That all falls under the minors on campus. So I know that, you know, you, that our university in general is not a mandatory reporter, but there are some individuals on campus that are mandatory reporters. Health and counseling would be mandatory reporters. So they keep things confidential unless one of these three factors are into play. For confidential employees, you know, we have health and counseling, so they have that they have that coverage by the law. They're professional, they're licensed, and so they will keep that information confidential. In the OCR guidance, we do have an opportunity to appoint anyone else we want to be a confidential employee. However, we haven't done that because it's really kind of a facade. It's kind of fake. Because if we actually had a case, they could subpoena those records, where they couldn't do that with health and counseling. So they can't do that with the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living. So that's why we have not done that, because in a way you're saying you can have a you can go to this employee and it will be confidential, but if we had a real lawsuit, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't hold water. They don't have statutory coverage. Then the final thing is a responsible employee, and that's if you're employed here at UAF. The guidance says that the Title IX coordinator must have knowledge of the requirements of Title IX, our policies, and then all complaints that are raising Title IX issues. So in order to have that, that's why we are building that central repository, while we're building that central unified tracking system. This is Board of Regents policy, and in Board of Regents policy, it only talks about supervisors and faculty, and it says that they have to respond and they have to help resolve complaints of sexual harassment, and they should seek advice from the affirmative action officer. That's the old name. Now it's called a Title IX coordinator, or harassment prevention advisors. That's the deputy Title IX coordinators. Now you're going to see that our policy has not kept pace with the OCR guidance that's coming out, because this is our policy, and this is the OCR guidance on what constitutes a responsible employee. It says any employee who has the authority to take action to redress the harassment, who has the duty to report, so you know that would be faculty and supervisors, because they definitely have a duty to report to appropriate school officials. And here's the really gray, fuzzy area. Any individual who a student could reasonably believe has the authority or responsibility.
I have a quick question here, May, if you don't mind. For this type of reporting, the responsible employee, would you need to disclose the student's name, or could you do it confidentially and discuss the situation?
I'll show you the OCR guidance in just a second on that. I want to go through this so you understand why I say that we need to change our policy, because here's how they identify a responsible employee, and here's what OCR says when the university is on notice of a Title IX possible violation. So if a student comes to me and informs me that there's a violation, if a student, parent, or friend, or any other individuals report it to a teacher, a principal, campus law enforcement, staff at the Office of Student Affairs, or other responsible employees, or if its notice is given to a teacher or dean that may have witnessed the sexual assault. So those are the direct ways. The indirect ways, it could come through a local community, like we got one that came in through the gossip mill. And then social networking, we've had some that have come in through monitoring social networks. So that's when we're on notice. And here's what OCR says for your question on what to report. It says for incidents of possible student-on-student sexual violence, you have to report the name, the student who experienced it, the students involved, the date, the time, the location. That's what OCR guidance says. We have had some cases where we have worked directly through the faculty member or through the staff member because the individual was traumatized and we didn't want to further that, where we make sure that they know what their rights are, try to hook them up with a victim advocate. The reason that we really want to have that one-on-one contact is to make sure that we're taking care of those students. The whole objective behind Title IX is to ensure that they can continue their education. So, you know, the best way out of poverty is a good education. And, you know, if you're part of, you know, if you come thinking that this is normal behavior or you've been abused in your past, then you need assistance in getting through this and visualizing a different way of being in the world. And so that's why it's important that we have this contact with our students to make sure that they can continue their education. Okay, if they come to Title IX and they ask for confidentiality, we know that if we disregard that, that would have a chilling effect on others who may come forth and disclose or report. So we take it very seriously, and we honor it unless there is a reason to override it. This is when OCR says we should override it. They kind of sum it up with if there's violence, if there's threat, additional threat, if there's a pattern, if there's a predator, or if a weapon was used for that incident, then we may go forward with an investigation even though the victim does not want to, because we have to ensure that we're keeping the overall campus safe. And what the studies are saying is that there are very few men that are perpetrators, because it's the study that most studies are focused on men. There are very few that are perpetrators, but the ones that are have multiple victims. And so that goes back to, you know, if we have any of this type of behavior going on, then we're required to move forward with an investigation. We will still try to maintain confidentiality, but we cannot promise it if there's a risk to the overall campus community. There's been...
Got about 5 more
okay.
minutes.
Okay, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, how do you tell a student not to disclose. Well, the answer is right in the OCR guidance, you know, like tell them up front. There are certain things if you tell me, then I need to report it to Title IX. You know, you're not tattling on the individual. What you're doing is you're getting them assistance. So, you know, some of the things that we can do for students is we can change their dorms, we can change their class schedule, we can provide them a mentor, we can provide them a tutor, we can provide them an escort, we can trespass individuals from campus, we can put a no-contact order in place. So those are some of the things that we can do to ensure that individual can continue their education. So I'll open up the questions.
Okay.
For the advocate that you've been referring to, has any thought been given to making that a student peer position so that someone who was in this position could go to someone that they could relate to even closer in a sort of peer environment?
I've had discussions about that with the Interior Center for Nonviolent Living, and they have some trained students that would, you know, have the statutory coverage. And so, yes, that has been a discussion. At one point, I thought I was going to be able to bring that on campus part-time, but now they said, you know, that they would like to pause, stabilize their staff before they take that next step forward. But, yes, absolutely, that's been part of the discussion. Thank you, though.
I have a question on the victim advocate as well. If we were to bring, or when we bring a victim, good. When we bring a victim advocate onto campus, would they still technically be a Center for Nonviolent Living employee where they were kind of neutral third party?
Exactly. I think that's important because it needs to be someone that they feel they can go to that's not necessarily, you know, working for the university. So that's what we're looking at. This is all preliminary. I've had several meetings with them. I got another meeting when I leave here today. And I'm just going to keep working at it until we make it happen. In addition to that, there's also some legislation at the federal level that if it passes, then we may have to, you know, have a victim advocate on campus. We're not sure which direction that's going, but I just think it's something that we need to do.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Brad.
I have a question about so mandatory reporting and then as it relates to the Title IX training and to the minors on campus training. If I understood you correctly, not all UA employees or UAF employees are mandatory reporters, and so that relates to the portion that says you have to report to the state.
Correct.
But for the purposes of Title IX training, I have two questions. So for the purposes of Title IX training, then if a student comes to us and says, I've had this experience, something's happened, I wasn't quite sure, if we get a sense they want to keep it confidential, can we say, well, you know, actually first if you want this to be confidential, go to your office? And then if so, do we then have to follow up with a report to our supervisor, or is that not...
If you refer them to me, I've got it from there.
Okay.
You know, so it's kind of like ethics, or if you have a job downtown, report and we'll figure it out. You know, so if you report to me, you've taken care of it. That way we can take all the steps that we need to. You know, we've got procedures in place for all of that.
Yeah, and then if it's a minor, if it's an issue concerning a minor, then it's not mandatory reporting in the sense of that the state requirements, but it is required reporting for employees then to refer it back up to the appropriate people in our reporting procedures.
Right, and if it's a minor, then we can connect the dots with that also.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions on the phone? Okay. May, thank you very much for coming here and doing your presentation. I really appreciate you taking the time to do so.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking the training and putting up with us. Well, this is an annual thing. Sorry, OCR, so, you know, we'll see more coming out. We'd, you know, much rather do it in person because it's interactive, and I think that better meets the needs of individuals. I personally hate online training, but that's, you know, personal bias. But okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. We're a little over time, so can we take just a quick 5-minute break before we come back? Thank you. Okay, I want to get going again, sorry. Hope those on the phone can rejoin us as well.
I'm sorry, I'm here.
Okay, good deal. We'll move on to number 9, officer's report. Most of the stuff's been talked about. I got two inquiries regarding additional soft closure dates. Chancellor already talked about that, so I'll refer to him for anything additional. But you know, with grading the way it is, if you wanted a soft closure, really meant that you could take annual leave. That the department would encourage annual leave if you were able to do so. I think that's great. I wish I could before Christmas take a few days off and do some shopping. But the two other things I want to talk about is and they're further down the list too. But furlough committee. Me and Trish are on that for UAF staff council. It's actually a task force that has been charged to draft regulations for the proposed furlough policy. We've been working on that for about 2 months or maybe a little more than that.
And this past week, I think Thursday or Friday, our draft kind of finished. And we, I've got a report out. I just wrote it last night, so it's paper that got handed out. But it lists out kind of this section, and I'll email that out for those of you on the phone after the meeting. But it kind of lists out the areas of the regulations that we talked about. It is not approved yet. I mean, it currently is with the General Counsel's office, they're going to look that over and probably look at some language to make sure it's all legal. And then it'll come back to us. What I think is important to note, though, is that the task force really sees this as somewhat of a benefit. I know that sounds crazy, maybe, in regards to a furlough policy. Without a furlough policy, it means that in budget hard times, it means layoffs. All right. If you don't have a furlough policy, there's no way to furlough someone, and therefore you're going to have layoffs instead. So furlough is a benefit to the university and could be a benefit to an employees as well. What we've tried to do in the regulations as a task force is to kind to limit and scope that to really just specific instances of really major budget shortfalls, not making this a budget planning tool, but really making this a, hey, guess what? We did everything else we could. We cut costs. We did this. We did that. And we still don't have the money, and therefore here's a furlough policy, and we're going to furlough folks. Two things to note is that, one, the decision to implement a furlough period rests with the president of the university. We've kind of put in draft regulations that obviously, you know, governance would help recommend that or talk about that before he makes that decision, but that really lies with him, not with a chancellor, not with campus directors, definitely not with deans, because then it becomes a budget planning tool. And that it really is, even though in all the news that have come out in the past week, there are no plans to furlough in the near future. It is not that dire. It may look like that, but there really are no plans to do so. So that's regarding the furlough task force. The other thing is that the Planning and Budget Committee, you probably saw that the Chancellor's memo as well as the Newsminer articles regarding this. Two things I want to point out is that the Planning and Budget Committee spent almost 2.5 months spitting through what initially was a long list of programs, looking at numbers, talking to program deans and directors and folks from the colleges, and people from programs. Those programs got notified well in advance. Many of them submitted kind of feedback to the committee before this final list that you saw in the paper, for example, was published. And so there was a lot of consideration before that list became public. Second is being on that list doesn't mean your program is going away. And the headline kind of indicates that, but that is not the case. There are programs on that list that I think if you talk to any of the people on the Planning and Budget Committee, you'd say, no, we would never see a university without a program like that. The reason those programs are on the list is because they stood out due to either low enrollment, low graduation, or some other abnormality. And what the committee said is that it stands out because of this particular reason, and therefore we think a specialized committee, that's why it's called a special program review, should take a closer look. Not should just eliminate it. No, should take a closer look to see what's going on. Maybe there's good reasons for it. We don't know. We don't have that expertise. But it doesn't mean that the program is slated to, hey, if you don't pass it, you're out of here. That's not the case. I feel pretty good about the whole process we went through. It's not a fun process to do so, but I really do think that it was pretty thorough. So,
can I just chime in there a bit? I would say, you know, not all the programs on the list are targeted for deletion. Being on the list doesn't mean that's the goal. But both from the Board of Regents and in the past from the legislature, there's been pressure to say, all right, if you're taking these cuts, what are you cutting? And don't tell me it's just some bodies because that doesn't make any damage to me. So there is pressure from the board and also budget-wise to come up with about $3 million from the special program review. So there will likely be cuts as a result of that. But, you know, there were, like Chris said, several reasons for programs to undergo it. So some of them, it was just their students don't graduate, so what's going on? Because low graduation rates also puts us in bad shape in rankings, which makes it harder to attract good students. So, you know, there were a lot of reasons, but the discussion wasn't, do we hate the arts and love science? No, you'll see there's science degrees on the program as well. My degree is on the list as well, and it was a matter of enrollment trends and graduation rates that got things onto that list in the first place. But you know, you're certainly free to advocate for those programs in the community. I think you guys have probably seen some of the theater petitions circulating or comments out there for the theater program. They've been very vocal. Having those discussions in the community can be helpful at this point. So advocate for the and let's for that.
Well, this is Kim from over in the theater department, and I'm glad to hear that we're getting the word out, because from what we read in the provost memo is justify your existence. And I don't know if every other department is feeling like that, but that's certainly how we read it.
Yeah.
The words were
the same on the memo for pretty much all of the programs. So you guys didn't get a different message.
Okay. And the question from earlier is that when the chancellor was talking about money, he said that so the state is looking at more of a $3 billion deficit this year, and he mentioned the special program reviews where he said we need $14 million in reductions.
No,
$14 million
in reductions as a university if we get the same amount of money we got from the state last year, and that's because our costs go up, our salaries go up, our benefits go up, our heating bills go up. So if we get the same dollar amount, no increase, no decrease, because of rising costs, we have a $14 million gap. The state has a $14 billion gap because of oil revenues. So out of that $14 million gap, which could go up or down, we have no idea with the new governor coming in and with the legislature. They're looking at $3 million from academic program reviews. Then we're also looking at other ways to get money, other places to cut costs, and each vice chancellor will be responsible for cutting costs within their area too.
Okay, so I just want to make
a million, so.
I want to make sure I have this right.
There's a lot of moving numbers in there.
Hold on. The state has a looking at a $3 billion deficit.
Yes.
Okay. And the $14 million in reductions is if we get flat money.
Yes.
Okay. Because he mentioned it in the same section as the special program reviews, which was very confusing because everything else is said
three. So, the special program reviews is one piece of the attempt to close the budget gap. And it has political ramifications too, which is in order to have strong advocacy from our board and from our legislature, they need to believe that we're feeling the pain. And that's what tells them that.
Is that UAF $14 million or UA?
That's system-wide.
But the lion's share is coming out of UAF.
UAF, so when... The last time we had the budget, you know, last year's budget cut was you know, we all took a proportional share, so based on how much of the total budget we control. And I think UAF were something like 50 to 60% of the total budget because we've got all the research and stuff. Our budget's quite a bit larger than the others. I think this continues to be a pretty hot topic. We could potentially have, Julie from my office or someone else come do another budget presentation where, you know, kind of where are these numbers coming from and what are the scenarios. It is a moving target, definitely, as we wait to see what the governor's plans will be and his guidance will be, and then what the legislature will do, obviously. But the board did approve our request to go forward to the state. So,
does it? I forget what's it called. The Statewide Administrative Alliance, or whatever they're called, and us, and Anchorage—they all get together. The presidents of all those get together, and it's called the
Staff Alliance.
Staff Alliance. So, has the statewide representative to that ever talked about what sort of budget cuts they're looking at? How any of this is affecting them?
Yeah. So when not in that environment necessarily, but if you go to the Board of Regents website, just alaska.edu/BOR, at the last meeting, if you look at the agenda and attachments, there was a cost savings and efficiency report submitted that all the universities and statewide outlined what they'd done in FY. So that one, you have to caution. Statewide and UAF both said, here's what we did in 14 and 15 for cost savings. It was a very late addition where we added in the 15 things. UAA and UAS, we don't think got their 15 bits in, so they look quite low comparatively. But you can see the types of things they're doing. UAA, as far as academic programs, has also done this big program prioritization bit where they rank all their programs into five categories. And they're expected to be making academic program cuts as a result of that, but they haven't announced any of them yet.
On that website, alaska.edu/BOR, where do you go to find that?
It should be under the agendas.
Agendas.
Usually the attachments are...
After the meeting, I can have Nicole send a link out to that particular portion.
Okay.
Be happy to do that because I think it's an addendum to the agenda. And, that packet is usually the agenda of Board of Regents as well as all the attachments and addendums and things to it are, it's 500-600 pages long at times.
Okay.
I'll get a link out to that. So you can take a look at that, and let me know if you have questions on that, either me or Faye, for that matter. Faye's better at the numbers there and knows a lot more at where those are coming from. Mm-hmm. So.
Rich, did you have a question, and then maybe we'll move on.
Okay. Yeah. So for the academic programs that are on the list for review, if they are slated for cut, Is anything that's slated for cut first going to go through a review to see what could be reduced or what could be changed or streamlined? It's not just automatically going to get cut.
Right. There's three levels of review for this. So first is the, and I'm sure the Chancellor will be talking about this next week as well, but the first level of review is a review committee made up mostly of faculty who can evaluate the program academically. And the programs have been asked to include not just their numbers and explanations about where the numbers are strange or low, but also their value to the community for programs that have that big piece of, some other less number questions, basically. And then once it's gone through that review, their results go up to Chancellor's Cabinet, and then it goes to the Chancellor finally. If something was slated for review, there would be a teach-out. Any students who are enrolled in that program would have the option to finish the program. So these are very long-term savings, not save a bunch of money for next year. So
it kind of seems a pity that graduation rates are factored in because you can have a lot of people pay money to take classes, and drama and film is what immediately jumps to mind.
Right.
Because so you're not necessarily there trying to get a degree. You want to take classes. So.
To be clear on that too, one thing that was discussed was we don't necessarily have to offer a degree and, you know, 30 classes in a program to offer classes in that program. So, you know, any of the ones that are part of the core or that are electives or things that where individual classes are very important, but having an entire major program in it might not be. It doesn't mean it would disappear entirely. So they're thinking through a lot of those pieces. Yes.
Yeah, and that's why that's with a special program review, where you get faculty that are usually in that area that do that review, and that is in the planning and budget committee review. Most of us don't have the expertise on that. And so that really is looked at by people that know about the program and that are familiar with that area to determine that.
Thank you.
Sure.
And I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep track of this because I know that my faculty will be interested. The three levels of review, were the review committee made up of faculty who can address academic specifics?
Yeah, and program routes. So basically they'll review academic the whole packet first.
And program what?
You know, whatever they put in the packet, you know, whatever the program's response is. First that gets reviewed by the program review committee, which will probably be similar in makeup to a standard academic program review. So if your faculty are asking about that.
I've done so many reviews.
Yeah,
a community panel?
No, but they can include in the program's response. So when, you know, you guys will have there'll be a packet coming.
Yes.
With a bunch of questions to answer. And one of those can address community. So if you get, you know, with theater, for example, this petition and the letters and kind of the public support, I would consider that, you know, attaching that to the packet, basically, from my understanding of the process.
Okay, and then what's the second step?
The second step is that the results from that first review go to Chancellor's Cabinet, because they're going to be seeing things at kind of a higher strategic level, too, where they might know, oh, but we have this going on over here, this going on over here, and so it makes sense to do things, you know, tweak things like this.
Okay, so I'm not understanding the three levels, and I apologize.
No, that's okay. So first, the normal program, you know, the program review committee, everyone looks at it. They make recommendations. The recommendations then get reviewed by the Chancellor's Cabinet.
Chancellor's Cabinet and then Chancellor. Okay.
Yep.
Got it.
Yeah, sorry, I know this is a hot topic, and maybe we'll want to have more time on our next agenda for it, but we have a lot of resolutions.
And the reason it's called a special program review is that most reviews, program reviews happen on a cycle of every 5 years, and this one is accelerated. It's happening regardless of whether a program went through review this year or 5 years ago, and it's accelerated because time-wise this is a really constrained time frame. I think many of the special program reviews are slated to be finished by mid-January.
Well, they're all due December 5th.
Yeah.
So it would be lovely if they were done by January.
Yeah,
so let us know.
January is the target for the special program reviews, and then the other, you know, you would have seen in the memo, there were a lot of other types of programs being reviewed that aren't academic programs. So summer sessions, KUAC, athletics, the farm, e-learning. So there are other kind of support services too, where those ones, it's not review with the idea of eliminating, it's review with how can we kind of maximize these and what are the best models for, you know, ones that generate revenue, where does that go and why.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So I'll be really quick since we just had all that. So related to all those, there is a revenue opportunity program review type committee. It's kind of modeled as the same as the program reviews, but we're looking at kind of new ideas for generating revenue outside of, you know, tuition, fees, grants, because we know how to do those things. So I'm on that committee as a staff council representative. If you submit ideas for revenue-generating ideas, either through the form I mentioned earlier on the OMB website or just send them to me, I will gladly bring them forward to that committee. And obviously as a staff council representative, if something came forward that was, you know, double parking fees, I would be opposing that. But, you know, we're looking at just kind of different things that we're not really doing now or that we could do a lot more of, like intellectual property and commercialization. They've got someone on that committee. One other thing really quick, I believe I saw in the Cornerstone last week that there's a flu shot available in the Wood Center today, starting at 11. So if you guys want to get your flu shot, you might have an opportunity as you leave today. I had the flu 2 weeks ago, and it was miserable. So I recommend getting it. All right.
Cool. Moving on. Unfinished business, number 10. Elections. Richard?
No real update, except 16% of the staff have voted to date.
And that may sound like really low, but comparatively with last year, it's actually it's higher than usual.
Yeah, the norm is, I checked the last couple of years, it's been around 6 to 7%.
Wow.
Wow.
That's 10% higher. Okay, well,
so even though that's very high.
I would encourage you to tell your coworkers and your units to please vote. Did we send out a reminder yesterday? We'll send out a reminder today. Sure. Just a reminder to staff that that elections are ongoing. They close December 3rd, and to please December 5th. Okay. and to please vote for their representative.
It will change to allow 30 days between elections opening.
Okay. Cool. Cool. All right. Thanks, Richard. Item B, smoke-free campus. We attached the resolution that Faculty Senate passed. They took our resolution and said, yeah, that looks good, and we'll add this, this, and this to it. And so that is included in your packet. There are some draft regulations out regarding a policy from statewide. I know you want to talk about that a little bit, Brad?
Sure.
Brad's on the
Fresh Air Campus Challenge Committee, so FACC Committee.
Okay.
I guess I'll also sort of jumping ahead on the report for that group, but that report's attached. The short version is that previously the FACC chairs, and that's Brad Loblin and Chris Racina, had sort of described the goal to be make a recommendation to the chancellor about whether or not to implement some kind of policy change. And with the news that the president and the chancellors have drafted regulations for a tobacco-free campus for all of the UA system, I would guess that now our goal is going to, the committee's group goal is going to change to how will we implement this here at UAF. And according to Eric Seasted, the chief HR officer who shared the draft regs with this group, the chancellor was looking at an implementation date of July 1, 2015. My assumption is that these draft regulations can be shared out. I can do that via email or Chris Fay, if you were looking to share it from Alliance. But you got it at Alliance, right?
We did.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we just officially got it from Alliance a few days ago.
Okay.
I think it was right about the same time you sent it to us.
Okay.
They were sending it to us. But,
So I'll go ahead and send out the or send it to Nicole so it can get to everyone. And then you can see the details there. Of course, the regulations can be implemented by the president, and he should get input from the governance groups. So I imagine that Staff Alliance will be taking feedback back on the part of everyone. I'll sort of say the quick highlights. It would prohibit all tobacco use on UA properties, and that includes e-cigarettes, includes any other forms of tobacco, so you know, chew, cigarettes, cigars, etc. All of that would be prohibited. There are some exceptions to
where you can smoke, but nothing like sort of the designated smoking area that we supported and that I believe Faculty Senate supported. You can smoke in your car as long as your car is not in a parking garage.
I think if you're on a construction site,
yes,
and
if you're,
you're part of a union and your contract with your
contract
construction
requires it.
Site.
Yeah, another interesting exclusion is research sites and research vessels. So I don't remember if it was in this committee or if this group, someone said, what, are they going to make the sailors not smoke? And it looks like no, they're not going to do that. So that's you can get the rest of the details there. Oh, enforcement. The compliance and enforcement is spelled out in these draft regulations, and in short, there will be no fines, fees spelled out. Instead, what the regulations are asking for is that members of the community enforce it among everyone else, so that you speak to someone politely and ask them to not smoke or be aware of the policy. Signs will go up. That's part of the regulations. And then repeated offenses would be referred to, in the case of students, would be referred to the Dean of Student Services. For employees, it would be referred to your supervisor. However, there's a further note in the regulations that supervisors, before taking any kind of disciplinary action, have to talk to HR. And I assume that this is so HR can say, wait, they should go to cessation. And hopefully not, okay, let's document this properly so that we can then take action. So I assume the former, I suppose the latter is possible based on the regs. But it looks like the overall goal is to get students and employees to cessation programs. The regs do allow for use of
Hi, someone is typing and it's really distracting.
I'm sorry?
Someone is typing, I think that's on the phone, and it's really distracting.
Okay. It seems to have stopped, so.
So that's everything I've got for that. And I'll share these out to Nicole so they can get out to everyone.
Brad, if you've got them in front of you, there was a particular wording in there as well, I think, that made it clear that this applied to other substances that might be smoked, given the recent ballot referendum.
I'd have to read it more carefully. The definition of smoking does refer to any, actually, it still says tobacco-related. I think it is specifically tobacco-related, but, I mean, it should be noted.
I think it also says something about similar non-tobacco substances.
It might.
Yeah,
but
there was a particular wording. But worth noting from the university's messages is because of our reliance on federal funding, which, as May mentioned, would be disastrous if we lost it, we still are subject to federal laws regarding marijuana.
And
it's very unlikely that any UAF policies regarding that will change. So if you were going to submit farming ideas to the Revenue Generating Committee, I will say that that one's probably a non-starter. So don't spend too much time putting a proposal together on that one.
Yeah, so one is correct, Faye's correct. So the definitions of smoking, read it. Inhaling, exhaling, burning, or carrying of any lighted or heated or vaporized tobacco-related product or non-tobacco plant product.
Yes.
So that would also include cloves or, So if there's anyone doing any kind of herbal cigarettes, yeah, that would be unacceptable. I didn't mean that as a euphemism. I know that there are people who do smoke cloves. But even still, state law would prohibit public smoking, as I understand it, it prohibits public smoking of marijuana anyway. So that would still be against the law, even if the university said, yeah, well we're not going to worry too much about it, which they didn't say.
Brad, I have a quick question. You said something about, okay, so repeated infractions of students would go to the dean of students, repeated by staff would go to their supervisor, which hopefully HR would point towards cessation.
Yes.
And then you said the regs allow for use of, and I somehow missed what you said right after that.
I was saying, so the way the regs are written, let's see, I'll just ask the very last part. Individuals who advocate for or are considering disciplinary action against an employee or student for violating this policy or regulation should first consult with their regional human resources or student affairs offices.
It doesn't spell out what that consultation will mean. My hope is that it would mean that, you know, someone in that office would say, well, have they been referred to appropriate cessation, et cetera.
Right, right.
But
okay,
it occurred to
okay.
me it could be, you know, let's make sure we document it properly. And I suppose both could be accurate. You know, if someone has been counseled multiple times and, you know, refuses to stop quitting or stop smoking in front of a doorway, then that might be cause for action. So I'm assuming that it would be it's so that it would be a more fair process for everyone. But it occurred to me that it could mean a more strict process.
I am, and I, forgive me for not plucking this out of my brain earlier. This has come down from Board of Regents with no enforcement, really, except narc on your neighbor or tell the person to stop.
Yes.
There is 100,000 people who are uncomfortable with confrontation. I'm not one of them, but I don't. It seems rather unfair that all these other people who are uncomfortable with confrontation, it's being laid on them.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that will all shake out. You know, how and there are related questions like, you know, if I'm a student on campus and I want to smoke and I'm getting pressure about smoking, you know, outside of the doorway, well, then I'm going to walk into the woods. No one's going to stop me there. No one's going to know I'm smoking there. Or if they, you know, they do, they're not going to report it. So there are some questions about that.
Which then leaves you open for moose trampolines and
there you
cats
go. That's
and,
right.
I mean,
well, and other things like, you know, development of more goat trails, as the Master Planning Committee calls it. the compliance and enforcement section of the draft regs reads, whenever possible, concerns about tobacco and related product use should be respectfully addressed at the time should concerns arise. Through respectfully informing the individual about the prohibition and encouraging compliance in a courteous and considerate manner. That doesn't say anything about their response, but according to draft regs, you know, the narking should not be,
aggressive.
Not be an angry response. It should be a, yeah.
So we have, Staff Alliance has a deadline of feedback on this policy of November 21st. So quick turnaround, but if you guys want to send comments, you know, regarding enforcement or these other things, Chris and I can bring them to Staff Alliance.
We'll send that document out today, and feedback on that, just send it directly to Nicole, to that email address, and we'll gather that feedback and make sure that it gets to Staff Alliance before that deadline.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, Nicole will send out a Google form for your feedback on that, maybe with the proposed policy, so you get them in one spot.
Can we still comment on the fact that there is no provision for designated spots?
Yes.
Yeah, please do.
Thank you.
That was my first response, so I said that one already, but I think if we can say that this was a major issue and not just a phase issue, then.
These confrontations would be a lot more polite if they had.
Yes, if we could just say, go over here.
Go over there.
But I also, I'm with you, Kim. I would not tell anyone not to smoke or to move. I would feel really uncomfortable doing that. So I think it's an effective strategy.
Attempted social engineering through regulation.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
All right, let's move on to the UAF Staff Alliance proposed University of Alaska core values. We have a feedback form up for that. We haven't really received anything regarding that. Does anyone that had a chance to take a look at those?
I don't remember getting that. Could you send that back out?
Sure. You bet. We'll probably move that then to. We'll make sure that it's listed on next meeting's agenda to talk more about that.
Did Staff Alliance have a due date when they wanted feedback?
No.
Okay.
There's no due date. There is a sense that if we don't put something forward, something will be handed to us. So it's our own internal timeline, but it should move.
Yeah. Meeting schedule for next year. And we had a survey done. Not everybody responded to that, but it looks like the majority would like to meet on Monday mornings.
That's page 17 in your agendas if you wanted to see the results.
And the Monday date was a result of potential savings, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it's cost savings involved with the setup of this room here.
Right, and chancellor availability?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, chancellor's more available on Monday mornings as well.
It's not a guarantee of his availability. However, it does check out in his schedule at this time.
Sure, it increases the probability.
Yeah.
I don't see on the draft motion, I don't see where it has a schedule.
Draft motion came before the survey closed.
So that bit in. Was it the first Monday or the second?
Wait, I forget. What time? I'm trying to pull up my document again. What Mondays at what time?
Time was not set.
Okay.
Just it was in the morning was.
Yeah, Monday morning. So that's anywhere from.
I read that to be the same time as it is right now, just on Monday.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Phew.
Well, we had talked in the email. I talked about bumping it down later.
Yeah, maybe to 9 o'clock. Starting time, that's something we can discuss, yeah.
I think the big thing right now is getting the date set as opposed to the time, so that's because of the staff council calendar, the printing one, that Nicole has been working on, and we'll get an update on that in a minute, but it's important that we get that to printing services soon.
And we also need to decide if there would be a January.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, if we're comfortable with. And Nicole, is it usually, what are we, the second week of the month?
If we wanted to align with faculty senate, it would have to be the first.
The first.
So the first Monday of the every month.
And for calendar purposes, Nicole, if we had the January off for now, obviously. Although, if it's the first month,
yeah,
that'll be
fifth. That's right.
It'll be the first day back.
Yeah.
I doubt we'd have forum, quite honestly.
Then I guess, can I put this forward as a motion? Like the language in there? Could we say the first Monday of every month except January?
Mm-hmm. For 2015, yeah.
And July.
Except January and July.
That is, if you still want to have, that would give us 10 meetings. We're only required to have 6.
Yeah.
September is Labor Day. First Monday
is going to be Labor Day. Good call. Do you know what Faculty Senate says for that?
I believe they have it the week after.
The second. Okay, so second Monday in September.
So we just say to align with Faculty Senate?
I'd be fine with that, too, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we may want to throw that in there since one of the things is cost savings.
Right.
Yeah.
And they only have 8 meetings, so there was, but it was still the cost savings for those
yeah.
8.
And it's almost $1,000.
You're trying to maximize it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that also does send a message to the chancellor and to senior management that we are looking. I mean, in tight budget times, government is looking to assist in cutting costs as well. And I think that's a nice cost savings if we can attain that.
It's small in the grand scheme of things, but it's large in terms of the governance budget.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and every little bit helps.
Yeah. So do we have a motion? Is there anybody?
I'll make the motion to amend the meeting calendar.
Okay.
To align itself with the Faculty Senate.
This is Sherry Ralph from DanCert. I second the motion.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Nay.
All right. Motion passes. Thank you, guys.
And the motion was just to alarm the faculty senate?
Yep. Then, moving on to item E, proposed term-funded internal applicant policy. We looked at this last month, and I believe we have a resolution in support of this so that the chancellor can officially implement this. All right. So you want to read that resolution that we currently have?
So the motion reads, whereas UAF Staff Council requested a policy that would allow non-renewed term-funded staff to be rehired by the university as internal applicants and included on a layoff list, and whereas UAF Chancellor's Office drafted the term-funded internal applicant policy and provided UAF Staff Council with adequate time to review and provide feedback, and whereas Staff Council has reviewed the policy, now, therefore, be it resolved that UAF Staff Council requests that the statement, application to the pool must be completed within 30 calendar days of the non-renewal date or of the notification to employee of non-renewal, whichever is later, be added to the language of the policy prior to it being signed. And therefore, be it further resolved that Staff Council requests that there be a single list for both employees that have been laid off and those who were non-renewed term-funded employees. And therefore, be it further resolved that UAF Staff Council extends its gratitude to Chancellor Rogers and to the UAF administration for their willingness to implement such a policy and their efforts to seek feedback prior to approving the policy. And therefore, be it further resolved that UAF Staff Council supports the approval of the UAF term-funded internal applicant policy with the changes noted above.
So this really, there's only one change to this particular document that we actually sent to the Chancellor initially, and he just sent back saying, yep, I made a few minor changes, but other than that, looks good. We just wanted to add one particular section there, which is what Nicole just read, to make sure that the notifications added to that particular policy. Other than that, this document hasn't changed since our last meeting, so we've got a resolution here at this point. Any discussion on this? Okay, we ready for a vote? All right. All those in favor of the resolution, say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right, thank you. Calendar update. Sorry, Cole.
That's okay. Now that we have the staff council meeting dates, the picture was selected. It ended up being the sunflower. And that will go to the printer by December 1 with the hopes of getting it through printing services before they close.
So yeah, we were just waiting on knowing when we were going to meet. So that now we know what we need to know.
All right.
Quick question. Was the plan that they would be done before the break, or they'll be done after?
I'm assuming, actually, I don't know. The plan was to get it through printing services before printing services shut down.
And they're scheduled to shut down, what, December 15th?
Is that correct?
I believe it's December 31st.
The 31st?
Yeah.
Well, but the holiday's in there, so.
Yeah.
Let's say the 24th.
Yeah, we heard from printing services that if we had it by December 1st, they'd be able to get us taken care of.
They've been pretty speedy.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, I imagine we would have it back from them before,
right, before
they shut
that,
their
doors.
Yeah.
So. I would sure hope so. All right, thank you, Nicole. New business. We've got several motions to amend our bylaws. Trish, you want to highlight these or talk about them?
So the Membership and Rules Committee has been working hard, feverishly, at our job of reviewing the Constitution and bylaws. So we're taking a section at a time and just bringing up. A lot of these are kind of house cleaning things, so some of these are just things that we had changed in our bylaws even a year, more than a year ago, but some of the language still needed to be cleaned up. And so the first one, motion 2014-255-2, there were some places where it used the word at-large seat and other places it used at-large representative, and it was kind of confusing what was meant by the differences in those. And in most cases, really, it just meant at-large representative. So we wanted to replace that and only use the word seat if we were talking about an empty place for an at-large representative. We also did a little bit of cleanup on some things regarding the elections. Was up in the section under length of term, so we tried to move those things down under elections where we felt it belonged. And with Nicole's gracious help, we also clarified some language where it had said elected and at-large representatives, but of course that doesn't make sense because even the at-large representatives are elected. So we changed that to unit and at-large representatives. Like I said, these are just house cleaning things. There's not really any kind of major change. Jessica, do you have anything to add, McCallum?
No, that's pretty much just what we've been doing, is making sure things make sense and wording is clear and everything matches. So.
Thank you guys very much for the work you've done on these. Does one of you want to move these forward as motions and we can vote on them?
Sure. How do I do that?
Make a motion to approve.
Yeah, make a motion to approve.
So I would like to move that we would approve motion 2014-255-2 to standardize reference to at-large representatives when referring to the role of representatives.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All right, this is done by roll call vote, so we'll start with that. Nicole?
Sherry Rolfe.
Aye.
Leslie Walls?
Aye.
Jamie Ward? Jessica DeRochers? Debbie Coxon? Jesse Atencio?
Affirmative.
Lawrence Murakami?
Yes.
Janine Smith? Aye. Jan Christensen?
Aye.
Jane Grossclose?
Aye.
Kim Eames?
Aye.
Juan Gula?
Aye.
Jeff Baxter?
Aye.
Trish Winters?
Aye.
Jessica McCallum?
Aye.
Susan Sanborn?
Aye.
Jeanette Ullman? Nate Bauer?
Aye.
Richard Machida?
Aye.
Earl Voorhees? Tom Langdon? Tony Abbey? Evelyn Pinsgaard? Selena Brown? Anybody whose name I did not call? Uh, 15-4-0 against. Approved.
Okay, motion passes.
So we have two more. I'm assuming, though, I still need to do them one at a time.
Okay. Yeah.
The nice thing is the next two are much, much simpler. So 2014-255-3. We just found still a few places where it still said alternate seats instead of at large. and we had changed all those seats to be at large, so we wanted the language to reflect that. And actually, I think we got down to just one left. So I would like to move that we amend the staff council bylaws to replace the title alternate with the correct term at large in every place that it appears in the bylaws.
A second.
All right. Moved and seconded. Any discussion further?
Thank you again. I find that really drudgery on this kind of thing. Thank you. So I don't have to do it.
All right. let's proceed with the roll call vote.
Sherry?
Aye.
Leslie?
Aye.
Jamie? Jessica? Drochers? Debbie Coxon? Jesse?
Yes.
Lawrence?
Aye.
Janine?
Aye.
Jen?
Aye.
Jane?
Aye.
Kim?
Sorry, aye. I had to get to the button.
Did you say aye or?
Aye, yes.
Juan?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Trish?
Aye.
Jessica McCallum?
Aye.
Susan?
Aye.
Jeanette? Nate?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Earl? Tom? Tony? Evelyn? Selena? Anybody whose name I did not call? Against.
All right. Thank you very much. One more.
One more for today. So this is motion 2014-255-4. And we're doing two things with this motion. One is it says that the Membership and Rules Committee is to maintain the membership list, but we found that really the Secretary of Staff Council has the most up-to-date information. And so we wanted to move that responsibility to the Secretary. She has the better information, and you get a much more timely product than if our committee takes care of it. And the second thing was that line one, there was a redundant line. Line one said review the unit composition, and line three also said review unit designations and generate petitions for unit changes, which is the same thing. So we're just going to strike line one completely, whereas review the unit composition and maintain the membership list. And so I would like to move to amend the UAF Staff Council bylaws to remove responsibility of maintaining the Staff Council membership list from the Membership and Rules Committee's official charge.
Second.
Okay, any further discussion?
Is it really different composition and designation?
That was sort of my same comment, is that it still seems like there someone needs to be determined how the, you know, what comprises that unit. And I thought that was still membership.
It is, but it's just in line two instead, where it says review unit designations and generate petitions for unit changes as required. We felt that that summed up the same thing as reviewing the unit composition. Unless I feel like it's two different things.
It seems the same to me, but
we could amend it to say review unit designations and composition and generate, if that would make people more comfortable.
Or we can,
I'm
but
just curious to know if there was really no difference.
There doesn't seem to be.
It wouldn't seem to me that there would be any difference.
Yeah.
No. You know, just kind of using one word means the same thing, pretty much. So.
Yeah.
And I can't find anything in the records that we have that would indicate that it is something different.
Okay.
Although that's not necessarily an end-all answer.
I guess just to me, maybe I'm just in terms of clarity. I guess when I hear a designation, I think about like what departments or what institutes make up a unit. I guess when I hear composition, I think about the individuals that are actually part of those departments and units.
I feel like those change periodically. Mm. So when you consider individuals, probably not something that the bylaws need to cover.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Understood. Yeah. Does that work?
Sure. Yeah. So then, just remove composition, I guess, yeah. Which is what you guys were talking mm-hmm. about tonight.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the discussion.
Yeah.
We were really trying to hammer out what our job really was, so it's so nice to have other people discussing this with us.
Cool, but I don't hear. Oh, go ahead, Richard.
I think you know just some background. I think that the composition came in because there are some people who are members of a unit, but they actually exist somewhere else, and so they actually are part of a different. Even though their department is all here, they're actually over here. There were I think a handful of examples of that, based on their physical location rather than their. The department that they were part of. I think that's where that original distinction came from.
I see. Okay.
So do you think composition then kind of takes both of them in?
I think it probably would. I mean, it seems like a more universal term, but if we don't want to account for specific individuals within the bylaws, like Jane was saying, then maybe that would be a reason to avoid the term composition.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually maybe having it in the bylaws would be helpful because it would be clear if we had an individual come to us with that question or concern that we would know who would be responsible for determining where they belong.
Mm-hmm.
But I do agree that composition can incorporate both which units are part of Staff Council Unit 13, for example, and then who belongs to those subunits. So who are we counting as GI? Who are we counting as? So maybe if we just replace designation with composition, that could be a...
Or like you suggested, yeah. We can have both terms under point number two.
Yeah.
Review unit designation and composition.
If we're going to do that, though, I'd like some language to make it clear because we all know now what we're saying in this room. But again, somebody else is going to be picking this up later who's going to be the committee at that point. And they're going to say, what the heck's the difference?
So what if the language said under item 2, review unit designations and compositions and generate petitions for unit changes as required, where unit designations indicates organizational areas belonging to a staff council unit and composition refers to individuals. Or something along those lines, where we could spell it out right there in number 2.
That seems good.
Yeah.
As long as it's clear what we're supposed to, what we're in,
what are we doing?
What our job is. Just make sure we do it. Yeah.
Need to mentor your replacement.
We're trying to keep good notes.
Yeah.
So, do I hear an amendment to this motion, or do
yes.
you want to withdraw it and come back to that later?
No, I'd rather amend and just get
okay.
it done.
Yeah.
We want to move on to our next section.
Okay.
So, we would still like to strike line 1,
mm-hmm.
and we would like to modify the what had been line 3 and is now line 2
mm-hmm.
to say, what Faye said.
Review unit designations and composition and generate petitions for unit changes as required, where designation, end quote, refers to the organizational unit making up a staff council unit, and composition refers to individuals within units. I don't know. Is that clear to people?
Yes.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, got an amendment. Can I hear a second?
Second.
Any further discussion?
Can I just quickly, I don't know if this, just in terms of archiving and minutes and stuff, the motion, there's a discrepancy between the number on the draft. It just says 555 instead of 255. While people are amending it, while people are making changes to it.
Oh, right at the very top. The header's right, but the first line under the word draft says 555 instead of 255.
The title?
Good catch. Thanks, Nate.
I was just initially a little bit confused.
No, I'm glad you had it. Oh, yeah, thank you.
I think that's just an administrative deal, yeah.
Fine, yeah.
But thanks, Bill. Thanks for pointing it out.
Thank you.
Just pick on Christian.
No, it's good. All the help we can get, we appreciate.
Further discussion on the amendment first. Okay, thanks.
Do we need to roll call by for the amendment?
Okay.
No, for the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor for the amendment of this motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Then I'd like to move on to roll call vote for the motion itself.
And Chris, may I interrupt? I can't actually make a motion, but I would suggest that someone make a motion to adjust line 3, accept petitions for proposed changes to unit designations from constituents, and add unit designations and composition, and unit composition. Otherwise, it's written as though if you want to change your designation, a unit can petition that, but if you want to change your composition, you can't petition that.
So I would like to move that we modify the language in the new line 3 to say accept petitions for proposed changes to unit designations and unit compositions from constituents. Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing or seeing none? All those in favor of this amendment, go ahead. On the phone? Okay. So all those in favor of the second amendment to this motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Now we've got a motion on the floor.
Do we have to do an amendment to update the wording and the reasoning on the motion, or can we add that later as an administrative change?
Since that's not part of the official motion, then
okay.
No, not as far as I know. All right, are we ready for a roll call vote on this motion? All right, let's do a roll call vote, Nicole.
Sherry?
Aye.
Leslie?
Aye.
Jamie? Jessica?
Aye.
Debbie? Jesse?
Aye, aye.
Lawrence?
Aye.
Janine?
Aye.
Jen?
Aye.
Jane?
Aye.
Kim?
Aye.
Juan?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
Trish?
Aye.
Jessica McGowan?
Aye.
Susan?
Aye.
Jeanette? Nate?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Earl? Tom? Tony? Evelyn? Selena? Anybody whose name I did not call? 16-4-0 against.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for bearing with us through this. Moving on to internal committee reports. I know most of those are attached. Richard, yours, I don't know if you had anything else on elections. We kind of touched on that already.
Nope, elections
okay. All right. Thanks. Elections are ongoing. Trish, I don't know if you had anything else for membership and rules.
Well, I had one other thing. We wanted to, you know how you have a safety huddle? We wondered if you would find it of value to have a parliaminute. So I'm going to pass these out. So one of the other jobs of the Membership and Rules Committee is to kind of be the voice for parliamentary procedure for staff council. But there's a huge learning curve on parliamentary procedure. So we wondered if it would be valuable to just kind of have one quick moment on each meeting where we teach one more thing about parliamentary procedure. So the one I brought was I found these common myths about Robert's Rules of Order. And myth number one is Robert's Rules is just a guide you don't have to follow.
And the correct answer is, if your bylaws provide that Robert's Rules is your parliamentary authority, then the rules are binding on your group. And in our bylaws and our constitution, the last line of each of those says, the parliamentary authority shall be from the Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised. And just in case you were wondering, yes, there are other parliamentary procedures that you can follow instead, but a survey done in 1999 showed that 90% of North America uses Robert's Rules of Order, newly revised. So. Do you find this of value? Would you like something like this each month?
I think especially with this level of concision, like, this is very nicely to the point, but also very useful.
Yeah,
you know?
I think this is a great idea.
Thank you.
And
if anybody wants to join our committee, we had set ourselves a goal of trying to up membership, so we wanted to up nominations. And so our goal was to increase nominations, but we were trying to have at least two nominees per seat. And my understanding was that last year there were 7 nominees total, and this year there were over 20. So we felt like we exceeded our goal, and so we had a hors d'oeuvres and drinks party at the golf course. So we get a lot of hard work done, but then we reward ourselves.
And it was fabulous.
Excellent. We had a lot of fun. Excellent, and I would agree. You did a lot of hard work on this. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rural Affairs. I know Jeanette's not here. Is anybody else from Rural Affairs here?
This is Sherry. I'm on Rural Affairs, but quite frankly, I don't remember where we're at.
Okay.
I'm just being honest.
All right. Staff Affairs, Jeff.
A written report attached, and our next meeting is December 3rd at 10 in the Murray Building.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Advocacy, Nate.
Yeah, so we did do some significant work at our last meeting. We have a couple documents that we're eager to bring before the council, but because we have a pretty full agenda again this time, and also because it happened toward the end of last week, I think that those will probably get pushed to our next meeting, which we're comfortable with.
Cool. Okay. Thank you. Some external statewide committee reports. Staff Alliance Healthcare Committee, Leslie, I heard
you. Okay. Yeah, we just had a meeting on Friday. I apologize, there is no written report. There is a couple of important things I need to discuss. One is that since Debbie Coxon is not going to be on staff council, we do need another voting member for UAF. Currently, I am the only one. We are supposed to have two. Chris, I don't know if you wish to stay on as the alternate, but it also says that David Bance is another alternate. So I haven't heard hide or hair of him since he agreed to do that.
Leslie, did you change the requirements for the representatives?
You have to be a staff council representative to be on the staff health care committee.
Because we only had, it used to be one where we had to have one voting member on. Was the last requirement?
University. Thank you. Has two members. We only have one member that gets to vote amongst this group that votes with the Joint Health Care Committee. So the more people that we have on this committee to help guide our voices to the Joint Health Care Committee, so like I say, since we only have the one, the better off we are.
Okay.
So anybody that is willing to step forward, and they meet basically once a month or once every 5 weeks to go over what the Joint Health Care Committee is doing, the reports that we get from the Lockton reports are pretty important. And I say one of those things I'm going to discuss next is something that I would like to put forth and need to get out to every staff member possible that is on the consumer-driven health care plan. So So is there somebody that would like to be on the staff health care committee?
I would say this is a super interesting one and really, really important. So this would be a great one to volunteer for.
And I can tell you, I can't be the alternate for that anymore. I have so many committees I'm on at this point that...
That's what I kind of think.
I have too many meetings. Planning and budget meets at least once a week and sometimes twice a week. Furlough meets once a week. It's just a lot.
So I'm now needing one voting member and at least one alternate.
By the way, I just wanted to comment that David Vance commented that he was really looking forward to this but has not heard anything, has never received any email from the committee or from any of the other members of when he needs to be filled in as an alternate.
He can participate and listen in at any time as an alternate.
I know, but he has never even heard
when
he's held.
Then if I can get his email address, I will forward it on to the chair of this committee.
That would be great.
Yep, thank you.
Also, if we don't have a volunteer right now, if you need to think about it first, then you could just let Chris or myself know if you're willing to serve.
You know what? This is Kim Eames, and I am interested in – I think you said you need an alternate, correct?
Yes.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. I would be interested if you get a group of names, I would like to be put on that list and then, you know, whomever can decide amongst themselves who moves on forward.
And you can call in. It is not for those that are on, say, the rural campuses, that you do not have to be an in-person body. It is all, you can do it via phone as well.
It's mostly done over the phone. So, Kim? You're the list, and you're the alternate. There you go.
Wow!
Congratulations! Is anybody interested in serving as the as one of the representatives, voting representatives on this committee at this point?
Well, it sounded like David is interested.
He's not a representative.
He's not a representative of staff council at this point.
Oh, okay.
Okay. While you guys decide that, let me discuss the other big thing that I need to get out to all staff as quickly as I can. In fact, I'd like to request that.
Go ahead, Leslie.
That we put this out via the staff council email to everybody possible. There is a new IRS requirement that is making the minimum deductible, and this is for the consumer-driven health care plan only. Instead of $1,250, it's going to up it to $1,300 and to $2,600 per family. I don't know who's typing, but could you mute your phone for me, please? For the out-of-pocket maximum, it's going to up it from $5,000 to $6,450 for individual and $12,900 up from $11,000 for family. The question that we need to, in information for recommendation that we have to get to the Joint Health Care Committee is, does the staff that are on this or planning to go on this plan want to do the increases on a yearly basis, because it's probably going to continue to happen as inflation takes effect on the plan, or would they prefer a larger increase to help compensate for future years? So instead of just the minimum increases that we're facing now, or do a little bit larger jump so they're not having to consider every year looking forward to another little increase. So this is something I say I want to get something maybe on, not only on the staff web board, and they can say any responses that you get from your constituents or through the staff mass email to get it to me. I need to have some form of information or reply, preferably by December 1st, but no later than December 5th, because we have to get these recommendations to the Joint Health Care Committee before they meet on December 10th.
Leslie, this is Faye. I'm wondering if, because it sounds like there's a lot of very specific language here, and we want to be careful what we're asking.
Right.
You could send an email to Nicole.
I will do
with
that.
With the information and the question.
You bet.
So that Nicole can get it out. And that way the representatives will have a heads up that we're looking for feedback
you
on
got
this
it.
Issue, but they won't have to remember the wording.
Yeah, not a problem. And what the dollar figures are that we're looking at right now. I also want to, again, stress the importance of for next year's rebate. We're now in that period for filling out the healthcare survey on healthy roads. Any of your wellness visits, be it vaccinations, annual checkups, vision, dental, which are all counting to the 5-point requirement. The personal health plan or assessment and your biometrics is a requirement. They are not part of the 5 points. And tobacco non-use is one of the additional 5 points. Those are the easiest and quickest ones. If you do not wish to do those, there are other avenues through the Healthy Roads program by participating in it. In fact, they just put out that great one, don't gain more than 5 pounds over the holidays. Doesn't mean you have to be successful. You just have to participate. That's a point. You have to complete these by April 30th. It is a staff and spouse eligibility. Again, it's going to be $600. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact HR or statewide HR. They're going to continue to send out information via email and mail to keep people informed that this is, you know, the time frame on this. There will be no fluctuation on the April 30 end date.
Leslie, this is Kim. I have a quick question because I feel like it, maybe I've missed it, but I feel like it hasn't been adequately, we haven't been adequately informed about how we are supposed to prove that we had these tests done or we had these things done.
If you've gone to had a claim through Primera, that information should be fed into Healthy Roads.
Yeah,
it's not any. It's not any of your results. It's just the fact that you have went in for a wellness check. If you've had for those that have gone to the immunizations on campus or had their immunizations done elsewhere, there is a form that you can download and submit to them.
And we have Erica coming to our next meeting to talk about that too.
Yes,
because that was a common question. So any questions you want to submit before the next meeting for Erica on this topic would be good.
Yes,
okay.
She has a wealth of information on this, and she participates in every staff health care committee meeting we have. But she'll definitely have any more further information. But for those who do have their immunizations done, where it isn't through a regular doctor, where it can be submitted through or uploaded through the Primera program, there is a form that you could submit. So if you have a vision check or a dental checkup, those are all Primera claims that they're not going to submit the results. They're just going to say that, yes, this person had a well checkup.
Okay. In the interest of time, Leslie, okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Compensation Working Group is meeting tomorrow. Nothing to report.
All right. And Furlough Task Force, we already talked about that in my report. So I'll move on to external committee reports. Debbie's not here, is she?
No, she.
Debbie and I have to go
on council, and I had volunteered to take her place on that.
Yep.
And I have, because she's been gone, I hadn't had a chance to get together with her yet to see where that's at.
Okay.
But that's on my agenda.
All right. We'll make sure that your name's listed there, Nick.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jesse. Planning and budget, I already talked about. Tom's not here. Is Tom online? Okay. Fresh Air Campus Committee, we heard from Brad about that. And a report attached. Master Planning Committee?
The only thing I would like to emphasize is that the
what used to be called the Sustainability Master Plan has been adopted and will be added to the master plan. And supposedly it's online somewhere, but I haven't been able to find it yet.
Okay.
I think I found the draft on the sustainability website because I just went looking out of curiosity. But I think it's on the sustainability somewhere.
It will eventually show up on the master planning website as just another plan.
Okay, the other one's on.
Should that be removed from the list of current committees?
I think so, except that the idea is to review the plan on a yearly basis. There will be a committee form to review the plan. And I don't know what composition of that is.
Okay. All right, thank you. Tom's on hiatus. Tom's not here. People's Endowment Committee. Jessica, thanks for the report. Anything you want to add?
No, the report's on there. I kind of left the about the People's Endowment on there because I didn't get a chance to talk about it last time. It's a great committee. They receive money and fund projects that normally wouldn't be funded. So if you ever have a chance on the Provost website, check out People's Endowment.
Thank you. External UAF committees. One's research program. Richard? Have you?
Nope. No update.
Okay. Thank you. RISE board, Ian?
He attached
a very detailed report.
Which was related to the sustainability master plan.
Staff appreciation day?
Throw in there. I don't know that Ashley is involved with it anymore, although I would suggest checking with her before moving her name.
Uh-huh.
I talked with Maria sometime recently. I think she is still involved, but the hope is that HR is going to start this year more quickly than they did last year, and I think Maria is looking to be a little more hands off on it.
Okay.
But you should check with both of them, and don't just take my word for it.
All right. Thank you. And sustainability. Well, we already talked about this. Yep. Thank you. Ad hoc committees. Term-funded ad hoc committee. Larry, are you still online?
Yes, I am. The term-funded ad hoc committee did not meet this last month.
Okay, thank you. And then the training and employee, the TED group, right?
Yes, the TED group, yeah. Much easier. So few updates on that. We created a Facebook page to keep you guys up to date on what is going on, and it's UAF Employee Training and Development, I believe, or maybe just, no, it's UAF Employee Training, that's right, because we didn't want to have to change the name later. So if you are interested to see what we're doing, we will continually update that, and if you guys can tell staff, faculty to like that page. And we're also in the process of creating a UAF training website, so that it hopefully should be up and operational by the end of the year. And we will have on there what you need for trainings, all the required, where to find it. It will all be on one location. And so that's what we're working on right now.
There will also be a single calendar. Like, with the OIT calendar, you can sign up for an OIT training and see what's available, and you just click in the calendar. We're trying to get all the trainings, all the employee trainings that UAF offers in person onto a single calendar, too, so you can see what's there and register right there as well. And that will be on the same website.
Yep.
So that on the Facebook, find that, you would look for what?
UAF Employee Training.
Cool. Thank you. Then we'll do roundtable. We're about 5 minutes past our time.